like an animal. Talks like an animal. Must be an animal. Come hear the animal. Talking animal. Talking animal. Talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals. Good morning, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest today is Terry Simons, a veteran dog agility trainer who is internationally recognized in that field. Over the years, Simons and his wife have lost a number of dogs to canine lymphoma and known many other dogs who experienced the same fate, which compelled them to form the CLEAR Foundation, CLEAR being an acronym for Canine Lymphoma Education, Awareness, and Research. CLEAR promotes increasing understanding about the disease, including how readily canine lymphoma responds to treatment. Notably widening his educational effort in this regard, Simons has made a new documentary film on the topic, My Friend, Changing the Journey. We'll hear all about this and more when we speak with Terry Simons, which in a slight departure from our usual format, we'll do within mere seconds here on Talking Animals. First, though, I want to mention that later in the show, we'll hear a brief conversation from Africa with Daniel Sambu, of Big Life Foundation, a Kenya-based NGO that helps coordinate the Maasai Olympics, which allows young Maasai warriors to compete in sporting events as an alternative to their traditional rite of passage of killing lions. Also towards the end of the program, as the prize for Name That Animal Tune, I'll be offering a pair of tickets to see jazz musician Gregory Porter performing at the Straz Center on December 18th. Right now, though, with a reminder, we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing us at dj@WMNF.org, we're texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Terry Simons to Talking Animals. Good morning, Terry.
Good morning, Duncan. How are you?
Good. Thanks for joining us bright and early. I know your time out in California on Talking Animals, so I appreciate it and look forward to talking to you. We have much to cover here, canine lymphoma, CLEAR, the documentary, and we'll get to all those things presently. But first, let's talk a little bit about your background. How did you get into agility training originally?
I got into the sport of dog agility because of my wife. She decided she wanted to bond with our dog at the time, Rembrandt, and she thought the best way she could bond with him was she saw this fun dog doing obstacle courses type stuff, and she said, I want to go take him and do that. And I said, well, why don't you go ahead? I work nights, and so during the day I had him, so at night they had classes. She took him, and she had a blast. I went to their first trial, and I said, ooh, that looks like fun. Can I try it? And I was hooked ever since.
And how long ago was that, Terry?
1996, I believe.
So you've been headlong into it ever since, it sounds like.
Yes, I have.
So, Terry, when people get serious about agility training in that way, how many dogs do they tend to have living with them as just sort of part of that world?
Well, it's curious. You know, you start agility because you want to do something fun with your dog. And then when you get your second dog, you want to, that's actually the main reason you get your second dog, is you've learned so much from your first. You go, I've learned so much with my second dog, I'm going to do so much better. And of course, you do better, but each dog is different. Most people that I know have 2 to 3 dogs that are doing agility from the ages of, you know, puppyhood all the way up to 12, 13 years, 14 years of age, some of them are doing agility.
So over those years, especially since you guys got hooked, how many dogs have you and your wife lived with over that period?
Oh, my goodness. 11 or 12.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it sounds like it would quickly get up there. So you've lived with a lot of dogs, and you've known a lot more, just obviously from going to all the competitions. So it stands to reason, unfortunately, that you've experienced and seen the loss of a lot of dogs, which I guess brings us, in a sense, to kind of the focus of today's conversation, canine lymphoma. So maybe you can briefly summarize how many of your own dogs you've lost to that, which obviously helped spur your efforts in this regard that we will kind of be focusing on this morning.
Well, my wife and I have lost 3 dogs to lymphoma. The first dog we lost to lymphoma was Roxanne. She was our second dog. We lost her to lymphoma at 11. The next dog we lost to lymphoma was Tango, a Nova Scotia duck-tolling retriever, as were Roxanne, and Rembrandt. Rembrandt was just lost to old age. Tango was 14 and a half when he succumbed to lymphoma. Not much we could do at 14 and a half. You just let him go when the time comes. And then there's Reveille. Now, Reveille, as you know, is the main reason behind Clear. My wife and I lost Tango and Curry, our border collie, 9 days apart in August of 2011. And it was kind of heart-wrenching to lose two dogs at 14 and a half, so close apart. And then a couple months later, on November 23rd, Reveille was diagnosed with nasal lymphoma and chronic lymphocytic leukemia. And it just struck a chord, and I just didn't know what to do.
And Terry, do you think it was because it was sort of bunched up losing those dogs together, or what other reason did Reveille's passing hit you sort of so much harder, it sounds like, in this sense?
Well, it was hard. When we lost the first two dogs 9 days apart, Tango and Curry, that was really, really rough. And then 3 months later, to find that my heart and soul dog, Reveille, is diagnosed with lymphoma, it struck me even worse, and I did not know what to do with my emotions. So it was quite funny that I liken it when I talk to people. I said, you know, I felt like I didn't know what to do, but I wanted to do something I had no clue about, and I felt like I was Spanky and the gang. Hey, Alfalfa, let's do a show. Darla needs a new pair of shoes. I mean, it was like, I'm just going to go into this, and I'm just going to do this thing without any idea of what it was I was doing. It was a combination of everything. And then as I grew into creating the foundation, I learned that it was Reveille's passion that her and I dealt with. I mean, I've never trained a dog harder in my life. It wasn't until she was about nearly 3 years of age before we became a team, and I could see in her eyes that she was accepting me as her person. She was a border collie who didn't have, you know, the drive gene, the tug gene, the I want to be with you gene. I really had to train everything in that dog that I got out of her, which was probably why she was my heart and soul.
Yeah, sounds like there was just a particularly profound bond and relationship with Reveille.
So
here's the thing, though, Terry. I mean, it's safe to say, unfortunately, that all of us as animal lovers have lost dogs and or cats over the years to illness of one kind or another, but have not, even if we're grief-stricken, which we all are at the moment and sometimes for a long period after those losses, have not been moved to create an organization to help their fellow animal lovers learn about that given disease that took that cat or that dog, or help prevent that disease or promote research of that disease. Yet that's exactly what you did. So other than not knowing kind of what to do about your grief and the sort of extra powerful connection you have with Reveille, why do you think how you decided to proceed?
Well, originally when I thought I would do this, I was just going to create a foundation that was going to take money and funnel it elsewhere. So that was it. I'd just give me some money, and I'm going to give it to somebody else to do what they can do with it, because I'm just one person. Well, I talked to a Dr. Greg Ogilvie, one of the top canine oncologists in the country, and he said, Terry, you can do far greater things than that. That's not what you want to do. And I said, but Greg, I'm just one person. He said, I see you doing greater things. And I said, okay. And I didn't know what I was going to do with the foundation. You know, as you said, this acronym I have, CLEAR, Canine Lymphoma Education, Awareness, and Research. When I created that, I went, oh, that sounds really cool. That sounds really neat. Well, after I did that, I kind of realized no matter how much research we do, if pet guardians are not made aware, if they are not educated about the disease, all that research doesn't help anyone. And I didn't want people to make some of the mistakes I made with Reveille. Now, I did everything I could for Reveille, everything I possibly could. I made some choices that were my choices, and I believe they were good choices, but they may not be the right choice for other people. And so I decided that when doing this, when I got the diagnosis that Reveille had lymphoma, I went in a hole and I felt sorry for myself. The next morning I woke up and I went, that's not fair to Reveille. That's just not fair. I decided from that moment on, I was never going to let her know she was sick. That was my job. I was never to let her know she was sick. And by taking that stand, I started to realize this is not a death sentence. Sure, the dog is going to pass at some point in time, but it's not a death sentence. And we need to inform people that cancer, whether it be mast cell tumor, you know, osteosarcoma or lymphoma, it is not a death sentence. It's up to us to do what we can for our dogs to let them continue their life and be a dog. If we take it upon ourselves and we feel bad about it, our dogs will pick up on that, and they're not going to be feeling good because of our emotions. I promised Reveille I would never let her feel sick. I would never let her know she was sick. And during her 1 year and a week from diagnosis, her agility career that year was the best career year she ever had. It was amazing. We just went on a tear because I was never going to let her know she was sick. I was going to do everything I could. We did chemotherapy. We did radiation. We did acupuncture. We did Chinese herbs. We did the supplements. I did everything I could possibly do to give her the best quality of life. And she never felt sick except for 2 days.
At the very end is when she really only started feeling the effects.
Well, yeah. Duncan, she did. I thought I was going to have to let her go probably 3 months prior. She couldn't breathe at night. And we discovered the lymphoma because she couldn't breathe. I thought she had a foxtail. And we took her in, and they did a rhinoscopy, and they did a CT scan. There was no foxtail, but that's when they discovered the lymphoma. If she didn't have trouble breathing, I never would have taken her in because she never showed signs of being ill. And most dogs don't upon initial diagnosis. They don't show signs of being ill. But I thought I was going to have to let her go one time because she just was having the worst night of her life. I took her outside, tried to help her. She kind of looked at the toy box. And I looked at her, and she looked back at the toy box, and I went, are you serious? So I opened up the toy box. She wanted to play ball, so I started playing ball. And miraculously, playing with her, 2 a.m. in the morning, lights on in the backyard. My neighbors are probably going, what is he doing? I'm playing ball with her, and she got better. It was amazing.
Well, boy, you've said quite a few things in just that last moment or two, Terry. So much I just want to sort of back up and follow. One is, yeah, as we said in the introduction, CLEAR is an acronym for Canine Lymphoma Education, Awareness, and Research, and it is pretty self-descriptive as acronyms for foundations go. But also, as you suggested, the education and awareness parts are so vital, not of course, to suggest for a moment that the research part isn't, but to many of us, the moment you hear any loved one, human or animal, has cancer, it's hard not to feel very upset, very worried, if not bleak. And one of the things that obviously you felt was important with Reveille was to not feel that way yourself, but perhaps at least equally important, maybe more important, to not let her know that things were different, that she was sick, that any sort of indications or at least give off any sort of sense that something bad was happening or was underway. And the other thing that you mentioned that's part of, I think, CLEAR's message and the movie, which we'll get into a bit more in a moment here, is how readily a lot of dogs can really respond to treatment. So you do get that diagnosis, but it doesn't mean, oh my God, things are bad or all is lost. And far from it, in fact, as you learned from some of these veterinarian oncologists, that there's all kinds of ways to go about treating those dogs and having sometimes a pretty nice chunk of time even after the diagnosis is made.
No, absolutely. I mean, treatment is effective for up to about 85% of the dogs, and 50% of those will have an extended quality of lifespan of over 9 months to a year, and then even longer depending on the dog and the treatment and how they respond to it. So you're going to get a good bit of time if you want to do a form of treatment.
Yeah. Well, let me, before we go much further, let's let folks know, if you just tuned in especially, that my guest is Terry Simons, founder of the CLEAR Foundation. CLEAR is an acronym for Canine Lymphoma Education, Awareness, and Research. and sort of widening this educational effort. Simons has helped produce a new documentary film called My Friend, Changing the Journey. If you'd like to ask Terry a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663. Email dj@wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. So yeah, this might be as good a time as any, Terry, to sort of ease into discussing the documentary, which not only features interviews with all kinds of veterinarians and others, but sort of case studies of dogs with lymphoma, which I think is really helpful along the lines of what we were just talking about, as far as people really seeing that there's any number of ways that the situation can go after a diagnosis, and there's any number of steps that people can take. So maybe you could talk a little bit about some of the things that the veterinarians and veterinarian oncologists say or recommend, especially immediately upon a diagnosis that is made, even though, of course, there's all kinds of different cancers that we're actually talking about collectively here.
Well, the simplest thing, one of the biggest things about the documentary, and it is groundbreaking because nobody's done something like this, is it's interesting to find out that people don't know dogs get cancer. I know it seems odd, but most people do not believe dogs get cancer. And then when they find out that their dog has just been diagnosed with cancer, they stop listening because they're trying to figure out, how did my dog get cancer? What happened here? And the documentary is there to educate people and let them be aware that dogs do get cancer and that there are options for you. There are options for everyone, no matter what it is. The biggest thing about this is I've had many people come to me and they say, Terry, my dog was diagnosed with lymphoma and my veterinarian is treating my dog. And veterinarians treat dogs with lymphoma often. But my comment next to them is, or my question to them is, did you see a specialist? Did you see an oncologist? And that's the thing that we are trying to get into the documentary, is that once your dog is diagnosed, it is best to see a specialist. They're there for a reason. Duncan, if your general practitioner told you had cancer, your next step would be to see a cancer specialist, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. That's one of the things that I found so helpful and valuable about the film is that there really are parallels, because it's interesting to hear you say that a lot of people don't think dogs get cancer, and maybe the further they are away from being animal people, or especially dog people, the more that would be likely. But my thinking was almost the reverse, which is that a lot of times people think, I just found out that so-and-so's dog has cancer, and the assumption I think a lot of people make is like, oh boy, that's you know, they're on their way out, or that's really awful. I mean, But what this film really makes clear in a number of ways is, as you said, there are options. And like a human getting that sort of diagnosis, yeah, you would immediately line up or get a referral to an oncologist. And really, one of the things that does seem to come out in some of these conversations, interviews on screen with some of the veterinarians and others is that a diagnosis of lymphoma doesn't have to be dire. But at the same time, it is wise to respond with some urgency. Again, just like you would if a family member received that diagnosis, or you yourself did, you would move quickly to determine treatment options, decide what oncologist you're going to sort of team with your GP or whoever else. And that's once you've done that, though, that things are far from bleak. And that as treatment options go, there's any number of things. Again, factoring in that there's all kinds of different cancers the dog we might be talking about could be diagnosed with. But there's just so much more hope to this and alternatives that I just think a lot of people probably wouldn't have occasion to know.
No, I mean, when I decided to make this documentary, I wanted it to literally be something that I could hand to somebody and say, I'm sorry your dog has lymphoma, but I would really like you to watch this film because it's going to help you understand what is going to happen. It's also going to help you understand that you have options, and there are options you can, you know, different options that you can think about, you know. And it was more just, I wish somebody would have done this and handed it to me when I would discover that Reveille had lymphoma. It would have helped me tremendously. The idea behind this was to create this documentary. I want to, and my friend, changing the journey. Our dogs are best friends, and I want to change that journey that they go on once they've been diagnosed. And I want to take this film, and when everything is said and done, it's going to be free to everybody on the website. Because yeah. I think everybody needs to see this especially those dogs who are diagnosed with not only lymphoma, but just cancer in general. I think there's a good story in here that gives them hope.
For sure. You can certainly generalize more widely from seeing the film to other diagnoses that wouldn't be lymphoma. And we'll come back to, I love the idea that at some point the film will be, someone could just go to the website and download it or just watch it from there. And we'll get into maybe some other ways that people can see it in a moment or two. But one of the things too that really helps is it's not just sort of interviews with veterinarians or veterinarian oncologists, although that's a key part of the film as well. But one of the things I think that really helps, it makes it sort of balance the clinical side and make it more kind of human and things to, for dog folks to connect to are the case studies that you tell over the course of the film. I mean, there's a few. Yeah. I guess I'm a little partial to Paul Newman, a white basset hound with the intense kind of blue eyes of his namesake. But there's a few in there that help tell, again, different ways that dogs and their humans have proceeded once that diagnosis was made. And again, it's just, you can see that there's a number of options and there's reasons for optimism.
Yeah, I never wanted to just create a documentary of talking heads. That would have been boring and turned people off and they wouldn't want to watch it. I wanted to create and intertwine these stories of these families dealing with lymphoma in their dog and their veterinarian oncologist and their advice and pet professionals and their advice. And we even talk about grief. I mean, grief is very important, but these stories all help you understand. And I think it's great for the veterinarian as well, because there's a behind-the-scene look. You're treating the patient, but there's a behind-the-scene look as to what's happening to these people as you, the veterinarian oncologist, is treating that patient.
Yeah, and also kind of we should mention that one of the things where those things sort of dovetail is one of the case studies is about a dog named Cardiff, who's human, is a veterinarian. So yeah. You sort of get a kind of much richer sort of story of different from different standpoints in that case. Although again, I still am partial to Paul Newman for various reasons. So you really do see things. And as you say, grief is important. And one of the people interviewed is a grief counselor, not necessarily animal oriented, but I guess sort of that's become maybe part of her practice as well. And even noting that at the time of the diagnosis, some kind of grief can often kick in, even if the prognosis is fairly rosy. So, go ahead. Sorry, Terry.
No, go ahead, Duncan.
No, I was just going to say, because I know I'm just sort of watching the clock. I know, coincidentally or not coincidentally, you're about to catch a plane to go off to an agility competition shortly here. But I just want to make sure before we run out of time that beyond the fact that at some point, and when what would your best guess as to when that point would be where the film would be available on the CLEAR website, which, by the way, we should make known as clearcaninecancer.com. That is the foundation's website. Where might people that are listening now have a chance to see the film in the meantime? Are there film festivals, screenings, tug screenings, broadcast stuff? What sort of things do you have in mind?
Well, right now, we started entering film festivals, and we hope to make note of our film through the festivals. The ones we've entered, we won't find out if we've been accepted until in January. And I'm only going to do some, we've entered about a dozen festivals between now and June. And we're hoping we're accepted to all of them. I believe we hopefully will be. But even if we're accepted to a few, we'll get the word out about those festivals and people could come to those film festivals and see the documentary. And, of course, we want to find some form of distribution and have it picked up by Animal Planet, so on and so forth. All that would be wonderful. Any money made through this documentary goes immediately back into the foundation. No one is making any money on this. I'm trying to figure out, so I can stay qualified for the festivals, how I can do maybe a one-day screener with a password that everybody can go in and watch. But right now, like I said, I'm trying to figure out how to do something like that, if it's even possible. But once all contractual obligations are over, like I said, it will be free. I'm not going to drag this out and make this a two-year process of trying to get it on the air, trying to get... I'm going to give it the 6 months till, you know, June, July, do everything I can, and if nobody's picked it up or anything else like that, it's going up on the website before the end of the next year for people to see.
Well, that's great. Of course, it'll be such a great resource. And I would think that one-day screener thing, by the way, shouldn't be that hard to work out. I know that there are passwords that expire at least after a few days or certainly a week. So there might be a way to make something for just that one day if you didn't want to, if you're worried about jeopardizing your status elsewhere by having it, screened.
Some of the festivals, some that we haven't entered, but I'm learning a lot about the festivals, require that there can be no streaming of the documentary on YouTube, Vimeo, or anything like that.
Yeah.
Where people see it. So I'm trying to find out the legalese if I can just do a one-day screener, because it is an important educational documentary.
Well, at the very least, we know at some point it'll be on that website, and we'll you'll keep us posted about that, and we'll let folks know. Let's see. I'm just going to read one quick email before I let you go, Terry. This one says, I lost my mail. Shiburgi, which is typically a long-lived breed, at 10 to canine lymphoma. He died within 6 weeks of diagnosis, which was shocking. I have always wondered if he developed the cancer because of either the vaccines he was giving or the Trifexis that the vet prescribed. We were strongly bonded, and he died at least 4 years early, and I still miss him after 5 years.
I'm sorry, what was the breed?
Is it Shiburgi? It's S-C-H-I. No, it's S-C-H-I-P-P-E-R-K-E. I'm not familiar with it myself, actually, but...
Okay, sounds interesting. I don't know, there's a whole thing about vaccines and not enough vaccines and too many vaccines. I'm not going to run that by, because I don't know much about how vaccines work, whether we're over-vaccinating or under-vaccinating, but lymphoma is partially genetic and partially environmental, they believe. Genetically, because there are specific breeds of dog that are more susceptible to it. There are lawn chemicals that have been linked to canine lymphoma, which are now banned. But I would do the best thing I could for my dog. Now, I don't know if this person and this dog did any kind of chemotherapy or not. Most dogs, when diagnosed, without treatment, will live 4 to 6 weeks. I mean, without treatment, the dog will normally live 4 to 6 weeks, maybe a little bit longer. So you need the treatment. I really wish I could give more.
Yeah, it's hard to respond more to that, but I think we should quickly add, too, that since we didn't really have a chance to talk about the chemo, that one of the things, too, that the film really makes clear is that chemo is very helpful in most of those situations, and compared to what, again, we would think of in the human world. It's not hard on the dog, or anywhere near as hard on the dog as it is often on humans.
They don't get the same side effects, and 90% of dogs do fine on chemotherapy. Minimal side effects sometimes is a bad tummy, low white blood cell count. Very, very, very few dogs will lose any part of their hair, although some do, But it's all about the quality of life. We're not trying to cure the disease, which is what we do in humans. With canines, we're trying to better the quality of life. If we were to dose the dogs like we do with humans, the dogs would just be sick the entire time. Not what we want to do.
Right. Well, Terry, I know you got a plane to catch, so we've been speaking with Terry Simons from CLEAR, Canine Lymphoma Education Awareness and Research Foundation. The movie is called My Friend, Changing the Journey. Keep an eye out for it, and of course, we'll keep you posted here of where you can see it, and the website is clearcaninecancer.com. Terry, thanks so much for joining us today on Talking Animals.
Hey, Duncan, thank you very much, and anytime, I'd love to come back.
All right, great. We'll definitely keep posted on the film and its status. Thank you.
Thank you, Duncan.
All right, bye-bye. In a few moments, we'll hear an interview from Kenya about the Maasai Olympics, an inventive gambit that has provided an alternative to young Maasai warriors engaging in the traditional practice of killing lions. That's just ahead. Meanwhile, today, we moved what's customarily our opening animal song to become our post-interview song. As such, given the conversation we just had with Terry Simons, I thought we should hear a breezy ode. The companionship of a dog. This is John Hyatt with my dog and me now on Talking Animals.
She marked our trail up the backbone ridge. How many times can one dog pee? Keeps me high as an eagle when I'm on the skids. I guess you gotta come down eventually. Buddy, I could have gone that extra mile, or an extra bark, or an extra smile. Cause I never felt so free. It was just my dog and me. Then she gives me that look like she'd lay down her life. No doubt she would in a minute, man. She'd face the bullet, oh, she'd face the knife, just to keep my butt from the frying pan. Now she's running up ahead to chase some deer. Comes back to tell me that the coast is clear. It's a different world I see when it's just my dog and me. There's a rabbit on the run. Man and beast and sky and sun. Who's talking to the birds in the trees? Why, it's just my dog and me. It's nice and easy down the devil's back. She wouldn't know any other way. Now it's over that ridge for one last mile. And we're fast asleep by the fireside. Dreaming these dreams for free. Yeah, it's just my dog and me. I never felt so free. It's just my dog and me.
John Hiatt with My Dog and Me. And I just want to say that we got some nice emails, including how to pronounce the breed. It's pronounced Schipperke. Thanks to Commuter from that. And also someone sent me a Wikipedia entry on Schipperke. So shored up my knowledge quickly here. We got some other nice longer emails that we can't at the moment read about other people's experiences with similar situations and losing dogs. But anyway, so my thanks one more time to Terry Simons for... nice interview, and again, a great film that we'll have access to in one way or another shortly, let's hope. Moving now into a conversation I recorded last week from Kenya with Daniel Sambu about the Maasai Olympics, the final of which will be held this Saturday, December 13th. A representative of the Big Life Foundation, this is Daniel Sambu speaking on his mobile from Kenya. So the connection sometimes is a little unsteady, but it's the best we could do. Daniel Sambu now on Talking Animals.
Thank you for joining us on Talking Animals, Daniel.
I'm very grateful to speak to you, Duncan. Thank you very much.
Maybe you could first provide a little overview of Big Life Foundation. What is it and what is its mission?
Yeah, Big Life is a conservation NGO registered in Kenya. It's a local conservation NGO. We do conserve all wildlife, and we work with the local Maasai community to conserve wildlife. So Big Life work in an area of over 2 million acres, and with a ranger, you know, the ranger's capacity of about 270. The organization was started as a Maasai Land Preservation Trust in 2003. Then it changes to Big Life in 2012.
And your title at Big Life is Predator Compensation Project Coordinator. That's not a phrase you see on a lot of business cards. What does that title mean, and what does your job involve?
Yeah, I am in charge of the Predator Compensation Program. This program was started in 2003 as a result of the Maasai Moran killing lions as a retaliatory measure. After a lion killed their livestock, they have to kill. Because as Maasai Moran, they have to protect their livestock to protect their community. So once a cow is killed, this Moran will come up with the spears and they have to kill lions. So in 2003, the founders of the organization approached the community and asked them, how can we stop this? Because if it continues like this, your children will not get employed, we will not get the wildlife scholarship. So all this will be in a way. So after several meetings, they said, if we want us to stop killing lions, then you must compensate for the livestock that are being killed by lions. And that is when the program, the Predator Compensation Fund, was conceived.
So tell us more specifically how the Maasai Olympics work and what sort of events it includes.
Okay, now, as part of, when we talk about the compensation fund, the compensation fund was taking care of the retaliatory, after every cow is killed, now the Moran with the spears, they go and kill a lion. Now, there was a cultural act, because even if you are compensating their livestock, the Maasai Moran still want to kill lion for some factors, for cultural reason, prestige, to prove that they are very strong. For every Maasai boy to become a Moran, they have to kill lion, like, including me, but I didn't kill, don't quote me.
it's a rite of passage then, Daniel, is what you're saying.
It's a rite of passage. For every Maasai, you have to kill a lion. So the Maasai Olympic was conceived in 2008 when the elder, the men who were entrusted to advise the young Moran, came up to the organization and said, hey guys, there is an idea that we can use to educate our warriors to stop lion killing and find another way of becoming famous other than killing lions. And after several meetings, it was decided the best way is to start a sporting activity that will preserve their culture, but will educate them to shun lion killing. Instead of them hunting lions, they should now come and hunt trophies. It was very difficult, Duncan, trying to tell people you stop this way of life and do this way of life. But after several meetings, they agreed. They joined with us. We organized the first Olympics in 2012. It was the best activity ever organized in our ecosystem, where over 3,000 Moran came and said, this is the way to go. And we used several measures, because we went even further to come up with a film that we use in our education meeting. And a special leader, a Maasai special leader, cast anybody who try to go against what we are saying. He told them, I will cast anyone who proceed and kill lions. We should stop lion killing and find another alternative way of proving our moralism, of proving that we are warriors, of proving our bravery. So that was the idea.
So it's kind of shifting the rite of passage that we talked about into a different direction, away from killing the lions.
Exactly. You give them an alternative. Now that you're telling us not to kill lions, so how can people, there are other benefits, like, getting girlfriend from the village, But now, how can we now prove that we are warriors? So we are telling them, by competing, you can become as famous as David Rudisha, another Maasai of your age set, who is now known world over. You know David Rudisha, Duncan?
Yes.
You know David Rudisha, the 800 meters world record holder.
Wow. And so what are the events, Daniel, in the Maasai Olympics?
Let me just join. No, David Rudisha is a Maasai famous athlete, and he agreed to be the patron of the Maasai Olympics. Now, these are the activities. We didn't want to bring in activities that are not in line with the way the Morans behave. The Morans normally run in the bush, trying to chase lion all over the place. The Moran always draw the spears, practicing, a target. And normally, during their dancing and singing, they jump, you know, you jump in a standing position. It's called a vertical jump. So those are the activities. They will be running. We have three track events, 800 meters, 200 meters, and 5,000 meters. Then we have three field events. We have the jump, now the Maasai jump, not the normal high jump. It's just the Maasai jump. You jump at a standing position. Then we will have a target. A target is, we define that one to be, you know, a certain round point is in a place, and then they will use their Maasai club to try and aim that target, and then there will be javelin.
So, Daniel, here's the question. Oh, go ahead, sorry.
Yeah.
No, I was just going to say, so the first one was in 2012. The finals are coming up shortly. But so far, what has been the impact on the lion population? I mean, is there a way to measure how much difference this has had in terms of the lion population?
Yes, I can say that since we have now the compensation program that are telling them, you know, you are not going into loss. Even if your livestock have been killed, there is something we are telling you, we are very sorry, don't kill the lion. Now, culturally, the Moran have shunned going to the bush standing lion. That one has stopped completely. And that, having a compensation program and the Maasai Olympics, we have seen the number of lions going up. When we started the compensation program, we have less than 10 lions. And now, after the survey that was done in 2012, 2013, we realized that we have between 100 and 120 lions in the ecosystem. That tells us that if we continue doing the Maasai Olympic, doing the compensation, then we are truly saving the lions.
Well, that's a dramatic increase in the population just in a short time.
Yeah.
Well, Daniel, I appreciate you taking the time. I'm afraid we're out of time now, but we've been speaking with Daniel Sambu from the Big Life Foundation. We're talking about the Maasai Olympics. The websites to find out more is biglife.org or MaasaiOlympics.com. Daniel, thank you so much, and good luck in the finals.
Thank you very much, Duncan.
Thank you.
All right, a reminder that a bit later in the show, I'll be offering a pair of tickets to see jazz musician Gregory Porter performing at the Strass Center on December 18th. Right now, let's step into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner. This is Eddie Izzard with a piece called Horse Whisperer on today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
Horse Whisperers, very touchy-feely horse trainers. Ooh, there, boy. Ooh, how tall are you? 15 hands. Ooh. You got 15 hands? You're Martian? A Martian horse over here. Oh, I see, 15 hands, right. Glad we didn't measure it in feet. Everything's measured in feet except horses, which are measured in hands. What happened there? Someone should be... I'm nine bottoms tall, you know. Really? Are you? Yes. See that building? That's 29 bottoms high. He's three thighs tall. Four kneecaps and a budgerigar. Horses measured in hands. What the... Anyway, the horse whisperers obviously, let's see. Horse is going, I can't quite hear what you're saying, actually. I'll tell you what I'm saying. What I said was, why don't you... No, I still can't quite pick it up. Just seem to be going... Horse shouters should get a lot further, shouldn't they? Walk forwards, you, walk forwards. Walk, or I hit you with this child.
That was Eddie Izzard with a piece called Horse Whisperer, taken from his album Live at Wembley. Once again, at the prize for Name That Animal Tune, I'll be offering a pair of tickets to see jazz musician Gregory Porter performing at the Strass Center on December 18th. We'll get to that in a moment or two here on Talking Animals. Right now, time for some animal news and announcements. Certainly want to at least hit some events that are coming up, quite a few in the next few days, starting with tonight. There's a holiday yappy hour and donation drive that the folks at Pet Pal Animal Shelter are holding at the World of Beer from 6 to 8 p.m. tonight. And it's the last yappy hour of the year, so you can bring a donation. Of course, you'll bring your dog, and there's adoptable dogs, Also, later the same evening, a wine tasting benefit for Pet Pal. So, RSVP is required for that one. More information can be had at petpalanimalshelter.com or at their Facebook page. This Saturday, Friends of Strays are holding an event at Jim Harley Davidson in St. Pete. It's from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. The focus of the event will be their Angel Tree, which is a way for people to donate for specific pets in the shelter. And sort of get the word out on their All Be Home for Christmas, Every Shelter Animals Dream event weekend, which is scheduled for December 19th through 21st. You can find out more at friendsofstrays.com or by calling 727-522-6566. More stuff this weekend. The Humane Society of Tampa Bay is hosting a pet photo with Santa and stocking stuffing party. So that's at the Humane Society itself. 3607 North Armenia Avenue, Saturday, December 13th, and Sunday the 14th from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. both days. And St. Nick will be there, so you get your picture taken. 2- and 4-legged children can do hang with Santa, get their picture taken. And there's other cool things on hand, including lunch, baked goods, drinks, holiday music, etc. You'll find out more by going to Humane Society Tampa. .org. Also on Saturday, Animal-Based Charities is putting on a Petapalooza Pet Adoption Extravaganza at the Seminole State College in Sanford, Florida. That'll be from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. You can find out the specific location and other details by going to animalbasedcharities.org. I'm Duncan Strauss. You are listening to Talking Animals, where the show website is talkinganimals.net. It's time to proceed to Name That Animal Tune. This is the giveaway, but please only participate if you haven't won something from us in the last 90 days. And there'll be a prize, a pair of tickets, as I mentioned a few times now, to see jazz musician Gregory Porter performing at the Strauss Center on December 18th. Please only call if you can go see Gregory Porter on the 18th at the Strauss. And if you are the first person to call in at 813-239-9663 and correctly identify this animal's tune, the tickets are yours. It's Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals. I can name that animal tune.
Sound like Birdland to me.
That is correct, sir. What is your first name? What's that?
I am Jim. I'm very pleased. Thank you.
Okay. Are you able to go see Gregory Porter on the 18th at the Strauss?
I will do it, and I will enjoy it.
Okay. What is your first name?
I am Jim, J-I-M.
Okay, cool, Jim. I'm going to put you on hold, and we'll get your information shortly. Thanks for listening. Thanks for playing. Congratulations.
Sounds good. Thank you very much.
We have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. I'll be back next Wednesday, December 17th, when my guest will be Mark Feldstein, author of Last Stop Before Rainbow Bridge, True Animal Rescue Stories, a collection of rescue stories about an array of animals, an array of facilities, rescues, elsewhere. Stories inspired by the great things Mark saw at the 270-acre animal rescue ranch in Montana, operated by his stepfather. His stepfather, Al Feldstein, was co-creator, editor, and the guiding force of Mad Magazine for nearly 30 years, until he retired and started the rescue ranch. So it should be an entertaining, wide-ranging conversation. I hope you'll join me for that next Wednesday here on Talking Animals. Also, we'll visit our website, talkinganimals.net. We make available all sorts of information, as well as archives and podcasts of all the past Talking Animals programs over these 12 years. And you can also have a link to the Talking Animals Facebook page or Twitter feed or more. Please like us on Facebook, the show, and or me personally, and follow us on Twitter. You can also subscribe to our email newsletter to find out about our guests a couple days beforehand and other news from the Talking Animals world. That's all found at talkinganimals.net. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals, be kind to others, be kind to yourself. We're closing out today's show with our thanks again to Terry Simons and Daniel Sambu, our guest today on Talking Animals. This is WMNF, Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weekiwachee, and beyond. Community Conscious Radio. Thanks for listening. Speak again next Wednesday at 9 a.m. on Talking Animals. Thanks.